after having sent it, the what I had in it, I was doing some research, because you know how you have a thought come to your mind, and you can't get rid of it, and you dwell on it and dwell on it, and pretty soon after you've dwelled on it long enough, you have to go do some study and to see scripturally where this is or whatever else you can find. And there were two thoughts that came to my mind. One is the thought of conspiracy, and the other thought is the thought of a conspiracy to commit murder. And conspiracy, you only need two people for a conspiracy. If you have one person can have a plot and they can have a plan, but when they involve somebody else with it, it becomes a conspiracy. And then, as frequently happens, two can bring a third one in or a fourth one in or whatever, until conspiracies can get really, really big. And you can have, as we've seen with Donald Trump, the conspiracy of the Democrat Party to destroy the man has got so many people involved, not just inside of government, but the mobs in the streets that are doing all the things they're doing, the school system doing what it's on and on and on. So I thought about this. I thought, you know, the commandments, if there is a conspiracy to commit murder, you're breaking the sixth commandment, because there's a plot to do murder. And that murder can be done in different ways. And one of the ways is to take away the probability of a person with cancer and heart disease to get treatment. And if they can't get treatment, then the cancer is pretty much likely to spread and to take the life eventually. Or if you have the heart disease and the heart is stopping for extended periods, and he and I have the same condition basically, but I think his heart stops for a couple seconds longer than mine does. And so when you take away any insurance, it has no way of financing treatment. And now you're basically at the mercy of the people who want to do you in, and it's Satan, of course, but you're also under the care of God. So in the letter, as I said to the judge, since I know nothing about you otherwise, I have to assume you're an honorable man. And being an honorable man, I would request, and I made a request of him, a couple requests of him. And it's not a long letter. It's about a page and a half, I think. Maybe it is two. I don't know. Anyway, so, but I had him read it, and I said, if you have a problem with it, I won't send it. So I did it. Well, I was in my research. I came across this article. It's called The Ten Commandments in the American Courts. And the guy who did this is, I don't know if he's a professor or what he is at Liberty University Law Review. Eidsmo is the guy. Eidsmo, I know, is not. And the fella, I don't have his name here, the guy who put this together. But it's an interesting thing. And what he did was he went back. There's a computer called Lexis. And Lexis is a law computer. And you can go, if you're a member, you have to be a member, you can go into Lexis. And it will have about, if anybody who is a judge in the United States, they'll have information on that judge. And they'll have cases. And they'll have the rulings the judge gave and why he gave it. And I first encountered Lexis a lot of years ago when I was going to the seminars for Christian Law Association. And I remember David Gibbs talking about it. And I thought, man, that's amazing that you would have all of this stuff in a computer. So this guy, Eidsmo, did this research on Lexis. And he said, I'm going to just read a little bit of his comment. He said, from the beginning of our republic through the present, American courts have commonly quoted or cited the Ten Commandments and other portions of biblical law in their official published decisions. But how frequently and in what form and for what purpose are they cited? Seeking an answer to these questions, I conducted a Lexis computer search in March 2002 to discover how often courts have cited the Decalogue. My research is far from complete, but when I inputted the words Ten Commandments, the Lexis search reported 515 cases in which that term was used. This included only published decisions of courts of record, the United States Supreme Court, federal courts of appeals, federal district courts, state Supreme Courts, and occasionally state courts of appeals. Further searching, using the term Decalogue, revealed 331 cases in which that term is quoted or cited. Searches for individual commandments, which I conducted in October of 2002, revealed many more. First Commandment, 26 cases. Second Commandment, 24 cases. Third Commandment, 9 cases. Fourth Commandment, 44 cases. Fifth Commandment, 45 cases. Sixth Commandment, 27 cases. Seventh Commandment, 29 cases. Eighth Commandment, 34 cases. Ninth Commandment, 9 cases. And 10th Commandment, 13 cases. That, to this point, as he said, his research is not done, but to this point, that's what he had found. Added together, he said, these citations totaled 1,106 cases. Then he talks about qualification because in some cases they might use two terms or three terms in the same case. In other cases, the Roman Catholic Church and the Jews don't have the Decalogue in the same order we have it. They have they're not equal. They're not the same in both cases. But in some cases, they have what we have as the fourth commandment, they have as the fifth commandment. Or what we have as the fifth commandment, they might have as the sixth, or vice versa. They might have the sixth commandment as the fifth commandment. I've not read those, and so I don't know exactly how those are done. But he is using that information to say in his research, you have to take into account that it was not just a case that said simply the Ten Commandments or the Decalogue or the First Commandment or whatever, and so that he gets the total of 1,106 cases. He said, I found that the courts use the Ten Commandments in several ways. Courts often cite or quote a portion of the Decalogue to underscore the importance of a statute and enhance its moral authority. Courts likewise cite the Decalogue, to using that term, Decalogue, to establish that a certain act is in fact a common law crime. Also at times, the courts cite the Ten Commandments to distinguish the common law from actual statutory offenses. Judges often use the Decalogue to interpret the meaning of statutes, for example, the Sabbatarian laws. We had in our country when this was a Christian nation, and one of the court cases he cites is where the Jews were complaining about the Sunday closings because they kept Saturday as their Sabbath. Seventh-day Adventists the same way. And so the stores that would be like dairy stores where you could get food of some sort or milk or whatever it might be, hospitals, businesses that were of that type were allowed to be open. But businesses like the furniture store and all these other places that are open now, everything is open, the malls and everything, were not allowed to be open. They called, in some cases they called those blue laws, but they were officially called Sunday closing laws. And in one case that he cites, the Jews had filed a suit to get this law overturned because they're open on Sunday. And the judge who rendered the verdict said to them very strongly, this is a Christian nation. This is a Christian nation. And therefore, because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ on the first day of the week. We keep the first day of the week as our Sabbath, and he would not even begin to consider throwing that out or taking that case, because this is a Christian nation. Now, I don't have the date on that. That would have been quite a while ago, because the Sunday closing laws were thrown out decades ago, and we began this movement. And the judge said in that finding, he said, if you throw out the Sunday closing laws, very shortly you're going to have all of the corruption and sin that comes along with that. And he cited, interestingly, whenever that was, he cited the desire to play football on Sunday. And he took exception with that, because it's using some of our governor's language, it wasn't essential. It was not an essential. So being non-essential, it would be blocked by the Sunday closing laws or by the Sabbath laws of the fourth commandment. He said, at times judges have employed the language of the Decalogue as a literary tool. Bray versus United States Denton Twine Company involved a patent for a device that was designed to prevent fishing lines from snagging, thereby causing the fishermen to indulge in expressions not altogether in harmony with the precepts of the Decalogue. In other words, they're cursing. A Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals judge used his literary skills to refer to the commandments of the Bill of Rights as "thou shalt not violate anyone's right to be secure in his person against unreasonable seizure, and thou shalt not deprive any person of life or liberty or property without due process of law." I don't know exactly how he made a connection with a fishing line, but that was his basis. People versus Vecchio referred to the statute that sets forth the various factors to consider in dismissing an indictment as the Decalogue of possible determinants. They used the word Decalogue. Ballingy versus State referenced an article by Federal District Court Chief Judge Irwin Devitt titled 10 Commandments for the New Judge. In State, Lashley versus Becker, interesting that Becker would be in there, dissenting Judge Higbee argued by analogy, the simple truth is that Section 57 no more repeals Section 1 or the proviso of Section 7 of Article 4 than the Sermon on the Mount abrogates the Ten Commandments. He said, indeed, the Master, this is a judge speaking, indeed, the Master gave a new interpretation to the commandments. Envy of another's goods is larceny. Lust is adultery. Hatred is murder. Still, the law, written by God's finger on the tables of stone, remains the Gibraltar of civilization. These usages demonstrate how thoroughly ingrained into our culture the Ten Commandments had become, to the point that the usage of this terminology lends instant recognition and moral authority to the injunctions they described. Admittedly, however, increasing biblical illiteracy may have dimmed Americans' recognition of the Ten Commandments in recent years. That's a fact, the biblical illiteracy. We don't know anything about the Bible. The Bible is not even a second thought, let alone a first thought. The Bible isn't going to come in. And in my letter, I quoted some things from Proverbs, and I said, I quoted the 9th and 10th commandments, and I quoted a couple things from Proverbs. Don't answer a matter till you've heard it. He that is first in his cause seems just, and a couple other things that I quoted. And when I did, what I was doing was I was assigning the biblical authority. This is the authority of the Bible. The Bible speaks. And if the Bible speaks in this way, then as a man enforcing law, you are bound, I didn't say that to him, but you are bound to take that into consideration. And so I passed that on, and a couple other things that I did. So the question is asked, it said, I don't quite understand this one, are the Ten Commandments law or legislation? Is that something a Congress passed? is it law or legislation? And the answer is, of course, that my answer is that they are law in the sense that the Constitution is law, the supreme law of the land, but they are not, strictly speaking, legislation. The Ten Commandments are a summary of the basic values of our society, just as the Constitution is a statement of the fundamental principles on which our nation is founded. But they need to be implemented by legislation or common law tradition in ancient Israel as well as in modern societies. Much of the rest of the Mosaic Law is implementing legislation for the Ten Commandments, and then he continues on down in what he found there. I wanted to go over to after he does the general statement there, he takes the commandments one at a time, and he gets up to the fifth commandment here somewhere, or the sixth commandment rather. He does gets into the fifth commandment. Interesting cases in the fifth commandment. There was a girl who was arrested for attempted murder for not caring for her father when her mother died, and he was living all by himself, and she refused to care for him. They put her on trial for attempted murder. Now think about that. Think about if a guy has cancer and he has heart problems, and you take an action to make it basically impossible for him to get treatment on those two, isn't that the same thing? That this is an attempted murder. So under the fifth commandment, he gets into a couple. He said the October 2002 Lexis search uncovered 27 cases which cite the sixth commandment. Though some of these speak of adultery and some cite the commandment, thou shalt not kill, sometimes translated thou shalt not murder as the fifth commandment instead of the sixth. The commandment is the basis of the right to life and of the various statutes prohibiting homicide. Sometimes the Decalogue is cited to clarify the meaning and scope of a murder statute. Gilbert versus Florida involved a man who killed his wife and claimed it was a mercy killing. The Florida Court of Appeals ruled that euthanasia was not a defense to first-degree murder in Florida. Judge Glickstein, in a concurring opinion, noted, the Decalogue states categorically, thou shalt not murder. It draws no distinction between murder by members of the middle class and murder by members of an underclass. It draws no distinction between murder by a family member and murder by a stranger. It draws no distinction between murder out of a misguided notion of compassion and murder for hire. He said, you murdered your wife. He said, look, I did this as a mercy killing. You know, mercy killing came in when that doctor out west started this thing of assisted suicide. And so the term mercy killing came up, and now we've had it. What the judge did to Terry Schiavo was passed off as a mercy killing. Well, it's a killing. The word killing is on there. You say mercy killing. The word killing is still on there. That you deliberately put this woman to death by taking away from her food and water. And she died of thirst. And David Gibbs, who was the lawyer, the lead lawyer in the case, wrote a little book on it and talking about the horror of watching a person die from thirst, what the body goes through, and that this was done so that a husband could have access to money because he wanted to do whatever it was he wanted to do with it. And the judge who handed the ruling is a murderer. He's the guy that decided it and handed down the ruling. So when that's going on, you have to go into the thinking, what are they trying to do to this person? Why would you conspire to take away financial support, even when it is money paid into a retirement program that at the point of retirement, you're supposed to be able to start drawing from And connected to that in this particular program, there's an insurance policy. It doesn't last forever, but there is an insurance policy that in Bob's case would allow him to still have insurance and he could still be getting doctor's appointments. So what kind of thinking is there that they might not even think about? They're so angry, or they're so bitter, or they're so full of hatred that there's something they want to do, but they don't necessarily pursue it to the end. And that's why in my letter, I pointed out that on the day of the hearing, he was in such extreme pain from the cancer. I didn't even think about the heart problem at the time. He was in such extreme pain from the cancer, I said, he may have not spoken or acted in a normal manner in your courtroom because he was suffering from this problem, thinking that perhaps the judge would at least consider it. And the lawyer that responded said he can't rehear this thing. But I thought, well, he's the judge. If God could take and let him think other than the way the conspirators are presenting it and say, you know what, there's more to this than that. And if he has any connection, know nothing about his religious life or lack of it, if he has any connection to the Ten Commandments, where he would be brought by the Holy Spirit to have to think about, is murder being planned here? Well, I don't know. So in this one, he said that he says to this guy, look, you might call it a mercy killing, but the commandment does not specify this distinction. In another case, it involved a profoundly retarded and terminally ill adult whose mother wanted to decline further treatment on his behalf. The Supreme Court of New York upheld their right to decline treatment, but Judge Cardamone, dissenting, wrote, the circumstances here transcend mere statutory and constitutional views and lead inexorably back to the author of the natural law. Author is capitalized. Author of the natural law, from whose foundation all law is derived. The imperative of the fifth commandment, which he's actually quoting what we call the sixth, the imperative of the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill, is reflected in the beginnings of the common law. As Blackstone observed, the law of England wisely and religiously considers that no man has a power to destroy life but by commission from God, the author of it. Our founding fathers enshrined the doctrine that life is an unalienable right. So if life is an unalienable right, and you have cancer and heart disease, then a person who takes away your ability to purchase treatment is denying you an unalienable right. Not only are they denying you an unalienable right, they are scheming for your death. Because what are you going to do except God intervenes? If God intervenes and somehow or other comes with a direct healing or gives you wisdom with regard to some other means of treatment. I found it interesting when I was reading Donald Trump's wife's comment about having COVID. And Donald Trump was taken to Walter Reed and they gave him some kind of medication. I don't know what it was he called it. And he said, man, that stuff worked. And then real quick, he was okay. She said, I didn't do any of that. I treated it with vitamins. I treated it with vitamins. And I thought, oh, well, I wonder where that's going to take Dr. Fauci. Dr. Fauci is going to have a problem with her treating it with vitamins. And she's fine. She's okay. So that's like saying, I'm smart enough to know that God in his creation put things in that creation that are medicinal. You know, I didn't know what it was. Debbie saw it, told me it was a wart. And I've had this wart on my arm here for years. I don't even tell you how many years. It didn't bother me. I didn't pay any attention to it. And one day, Candace was complaining about something on her skin outside. So I pulled my sweater up and I said, look, I got this on mine. That don't make you anything. You just have it. So earlier this year, Debbie started coming in every day with milk from the milkweed. And she started putting that milk from the milkweed on that thing. Do you know it's gone? It took care of it. God had something to treat that I wouldn't ever, I didn't even think about it because I didn't care about it. But Debbie did, and so she put that on there, and it's gone. I don't have it anymore. So if they say, we are going to see to it that you cannot have access to the insurance or to the funds that you've put away, that would get you treatment for the cancer and the heart disease, the result of that would be the death of the individual, at least in the thinking. That person's going to die, and that would bring them under the fifth commandment, or sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. So he says in this particular case, let's see, I don't know if I read that one. The circumstances here transcend, this is the terminally ill adult whose mother wanted to decline further treatment. The circumstances here transcend mere statutory and constitutional views and lead inexorably back to the author of the natural law, to God, from whose foundation all law is derived. The imperative of the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill, is reflected in the beginnings of comment. Yeah, I read Blackstone. Blackstone said, the law of England wisely and religiously considers that no man has a power to destroy life but by commission from God, the author of it. Power meaning authority. No man has authority to destroy life but by commission. Well, what goes on with abortion? Aborticide is the correct term. What goes on? Somebody is assuming this power or authority to kill infants, all right, that they don't have. And that this life is an inalienable right. Then he says, and this is an interesting comment. He said, there is but a short step from a mentally defectant patient's right to die to his duty to die. From his right to die to his duty to die. So once you say he has a right, they have a right, you have a right to kill them because they're in this situation, this becomes a duty. That reminds me of Barack Obama, who, when the woman raised the question concerning her mother, who is, I don't remember how old she was, but she was around 100 years old or something like that. And what could she do? And his answer was, Just give her the pill. The pill being a death. You're going to kill her with the pill. Why? Because when you're old, you're not valued. I never thought about this, and all of a sudden it's occurring to me. I'm going to be 86 years old here in a short time. Where do I stand in the mind of the current world? I stand as basically useless because you're too old. What can you do when you're 86 years old? Well, we're considering people to not be worth much when they're much younger, placed in nursing homes, and they're put in nursing homes. And in the nursing homes start an immediate decline in health. And it's one of the most horrible things is to walk into a nursing home and see these people strapped in a wheelchair, flopped over in their wheelchair. They have no life, and I would see that every day when I'd go in to see Martha, where you went past the nurse's station. They would always have half a dozen people sitting there in their wheelchairs, and they probably didn't even know where they were. And I would always make it a point to speak to them. And they didn't, of course, they weren't responsive, but I always make it a point to walk over and speak to them. And then there was one lady, as I went down the hall, would always be in the doorway of her room, and I would go over and speak to her going in, and I'd speak to her going out. And every time I'd speak, she would just brighten up. She'd get this big smile, and she never said anything back to me except maybe hello or something like that. So you say, wait a minute, this is an inalienable right. He said the Decalogue has also been cited to establish a defendant's responsibility for his actions. In New York versus McDowell, it involved a woman who called herself Jezreel Lord God Woman. She's Jezreel Lord God Woman. Affirming her murder conviction and rejecting an insanity defense, The court observed that the defendant testified at the trial that she knew that she was killing the defendant when she stabbed him. She knew that what she did was against society's laws, and she was aware of the constraints of the Fifth Commandment, but that she went by her own rules. In Illinois, versus McEwen suggested concerning Witherspoon excludables, these are people, Witherspoon excludable would be a person, if you're getting a jury, and the lawyer would ask the person if they had any objection to the death penalty. And if the person had an absolute objection to the death penalty, they would exclude them from the jury because they still were including the Fifth Commandment in the legal procedure. In Leroy versus Hurlburt, the people, I don't know what ex rel means, ex rel, involved the power of the Board of Water Commissioners. Michigan Supreme Court Justice Thomas Cooley, whose constitutional limitation is considered by many the leading work on the U.S. Constitution from the second half of the 1800s, surveyed the powers given to government officials in colonial New England. He wrote, "In Massachusetts, it was even insisted by the people's deputies that to surrender local government was contrary to the Sixth Commandment. For, said they, men may not destroy their political any more than their natural lives. So it is recorded they clung to the civil liberties of New England as part of the inheritance of their father." This is just, he has a bunch more, but he just puts these couple in here to show how the fifth command, or the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, is being broken, or has been broken, or has been rejected by courts so that it couldn't be broken. Now, if I go from that to my subject of conspiracy, conspiracies always intend harm. An evil conspiracy, I don't know if there is such a thing as a good conspiracy, I suppose there might be. If you had somebody, now you're going to counter Nancy Pelosi or something, there might be a group who get together with a plan to destroy her. But normally you think of a conspiracy as people banding together to bring harm to somebody. So the definition of the word conspiracy is this. This is from Webster, 1828. It is a combination of men for an evil purpose. A combination of men for an evil purpose. An agreement between two or more persons to commit some crime in concert, particularly a combination to commit treason or excite sedition or insurrection against the government of a state, or a plot as a conspiracy against the life of a king, a conspiracy against the government. In law, it is an agreement between two or more persons falsely and maliciously to indict or procure to be indicted an innocent person of a felony. So you're going to take an innocent person and get them indicted so that they become a felon. Well, if you have done this, and this person now carries the identity of felon, you have stripped them of their inalienable rights. Inalienable is a word that carries meaning. If it's inalienable, that means you can't take their rights away from them. You can incarcerate them, and as such, you're going to take, they're not going to have the right of free movement. They can't travel about, go wherever they want to go. They're not going to be able to go out and go to work, etc., for whatever time they're incarcerated. But that doesn't take away, is not designed to take away all their rights, so that they still have a voice. They still have, especially in the case of innocence, if you are incarcerated and you're innocent, you should still have a voice to contend for your innocence. It shouldn't be like this document that said you give up all the, then they list all these rights on there, including the right of appeal. That you cannot, this is what it's, one of the things it said, you give up the right of appeal. So if you can't appeal, then where are you at? You are at this little base situation here where everything is done wrong, But you have no recourse because you surrendered your right of appeal, which means you surrendered an inalienable right, which you can't surrender an inalienable right. Because an inalienable right is given by God. And the only way you can surrender it is to somehow bail on God, and or the right is not inalienable. If you can, in some fashion, have it removed, it's no longer inalienable. So in this concept of a conspiracy, you have two or more persons falsely and maliciously looking for an indictment. They want, now, the word maliciously is important because it is not only false, there is evil intent, there's a plan. So as I said in Bob's case, you have cancer and you have heart disease. Both of those can kill you. So if you have cancer, cancer normally, I don't know how his is doing because we don't get it, can't get a report. Cancer normally naturally gets worse unless there's some way you discover to counter it. So if there is a counter like Mrs. Trump did with her COVID, she probably didn't even go to Walter Reed Hospital. She just stayed home and took her vitamins, whatever they were. She called them vitamins, all right? So you have this situation where you are not only stripping inalienable rights, but you have a plot that is intended to finish in the killing of a person, and one of the methods is to remove their financial ability to purchase treatment. That's evil. That is evil. But this is the kind of thing that you're dealing with in something like this. In the book of Acts, I'm just going to take three plots out of the Bible, and you're probably familiar with all of these. Acts chapter 23. This is the plot to get Paul. They're out to get Paul. The Jews were. And so their priests and their the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the scribes and anybody they could get together had this plan. In the 12th verse of the 23rd chapter of Acts, it says, "When it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse." They banded together and bound themselves under a curse. In other words, if we don't accomplish what we're setting out to accomplish, they're calling a curse down on themselves, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. So these guys get together and they have a plan. We're going to kill Paul some way. And we're not eating, we're not drinking. Those poor guys must have died of starvation because God protected Paul and they couldn't kill him. And if they kept their vow, they kept their oath, they died. And they were more than 40. There's over 40 people in this conspiracy, which had made this conspiracy. And they came to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a great curse that we will eat nothing until we have slain Paul. Now, therefore, you with the council, signify to the chief captain that he bring him down to you tomorrow as though you would inquire something more perfectly concerning him, and we, or ever he come near, are ready to kill him." Okay, we're going to get together. We got 40 people here. We're going to come down to the magistrates or whatever, and we're going to say, "Here's the plan. You're going to call him tomorrow for a meeting for whatever purpose, and here's our plan. Before he gets here, we're going to intercept him and kill him." If this is the case, then you have a violation of the sixth commandment. These are Jewish people. They're supposed to know the law. You shall do no murder. And this is murder. So this is a plot. And it says in verse 16, "When Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait, he went and entered into the castle and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions unto him and said, 'Bring this young man to the chief captain,' and he sends him in." And the guy exposes the plot, and they enter in and do something, and Paul is rescued. Well, in a situation, where do you get somebody who can enter in And to whom do they enter in order to bring the information about the plot? In order to get whoever you're going to enter into to take an action to cancel it, so that instead of the person ending up dead, they end up delivered. And they are granted restoration. So if you read the rest of that story, I'm not going to read it, but if you read the rest of that story, you'll see that that's what happened. Paul was taken care of. Now, another one that you're very familiar with is back in the book of Daniel. This is the plot against Daniel. Daniel is not a Babylonian. Daniel is an Israelite. And Daniel is an Israelite captive. He's not just an Israelite, he's an Israelite captive, along with his three friends that get recognition in this chapter, or in this book rather. Daniel is an Israelite, and he is an Israelite captive who has found favor with the king. That's all of that goes bad with you. All right? So it says in verse 6, these presidents and princes, well, let me go back to verse 5, verse 4. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel. Why do you have to seek to find an occasion against somebody? There is a condition inside that's called hatred. They hate Daniel. They hate Daniel because of the position he holds. They hate Daniel because he is being honored by the king. They hate Daniel for all these reasons, and so they're going to get together and come up with a plan. It says, but they could find no occasion nor fault. The guy is straight. For as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. Then said these men, this is reality, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said this to King Darius, King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors, the princes, the counselors, and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now take that and say, we've come up with a scheme. Any person who uses a particular computer from home, this person's going to have to be dealt with. Now, we're not going to get it in some other way. We're going to have to get it in the law of his God. And the only way they can do that is to find out that that's where he lives. He lives within the bounds of the law of his God. So he said, and they said in verse 8, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it be not changed. Because that's the rule. If the king signs it, you can't change it. According to the law of the Medes and Persians, which alters not. Wherefore, King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Now, King Darius ain't thinking straight because he has a very tight relationship with Daniel. And Daniel's been a great blessing to him, but he's been led through by these guys down the wrong path. And when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem. He kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day, and prayed and gave thanks before his God. Wait a minute, the law says you can't pray to anybody but the king. If you want to pray, that's okay. We don't care about that. But you can only pray to the king. If you pray to anybody else, you're in violation of law. And in violation of law, you're going to have to be thrown into the lion's den. Daniel, I talked to you about boldness, being bold in an uncertain time. Christians have to be bold. And there's different ways for that boldness to be demonstrated. In Daniel's case, it was by open the windows, let everybody look into my house, getting down before God, praying to Almighty God, realizing that if I'm caught, I'm going into the lions. That can't be a real happy thought. There's going to be a horrible thing. What is ahead of me? Okay? Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. You got spies everywhere. Then they came near and spoke before the king concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree, king? Come on, king, we're going to get you here. That every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Then answered they and said before the king, that Daniel, which is the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but makes his petition three times a day. Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself. He hated that he had signed the decree. Well, we don't have that situation going on right now, but this guy hated that he had signed a decree because he couldn't change it. So it says, he was sore displeased with himself, and he set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. How can I get him out of this? And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him, but he couldn't. Then these men assembled the king and said unto the king, now, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king established may be changed. Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Well, of course, you know the story. Daniel's in the den of lions. And the king, interestingly enough, the king who is led to do something, the authoritative governmental figure, is led to do something wrong, and even just in relationship to his to Daniel, between Daniel and him. And he says they're going to cast Daniel into the lions, and the king says to him, thy God, whom you serve continually, will deliver you. It isn't the preacher telling him. It isn't the priest coming up. It's the king. The king is a Babylonian. The king is not an Israelite. And the king says to Daniel, because he has seen this correctly now, your God, whom you serve continually, will deliver you. And of course, that's what happened. Daniel goes in, the Lord shuts the lion's mouth, Daniel has a good night's rest, the lions have a good night's rest, the king comes in the morning, the king is close to having a what we call a nervous breakdown, because he doesn't know he's going to find a dead Daniel in there, even though he himself said God's going to help you. And you know the solution, Daniel was delivered. The third one is against Christ. I only have a couple minutes, so real quick, over to Matthew chapter 26. You're all familiar with these, I know. You might know them better than I know them. Matthew chapter 26 and verses 3 and 4. It says, if I can find it, 26, 3 and 4. Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people unto the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas. And they consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. By subtlety and kill him. And they said, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people. All right. Lest there be an uproar among the people. Don't do it. Well, of course, they did it. The uproar among the people, though, was the uproar saying, crucify him, crucify him. So if you take the time, I could have gone through and gotten a half a dozen more, and study the plots, how do they do? You'll see the same spirit in all of them. And the violation of the Ten Commandments in all of them. And that in every case you have a conspiracy, not just one person. Judas was not just one person. Judas was the servant of the bad guys who talked him into doing what he did, and he ends up committing suicide. So he ended up having a bad outcome eternally. He's still not doing so good. All right, I'm going to quit.